count in his house was way up. At night, he could see a dull, greenish glow in the rooms. His letter finished this way. "I hope you'll write back and apprise me of your own situation and that of your Fournet as regards enemies, Henry. I believe that reaching you has been an occurrence that transcends coincidence. I would call it a life ring from God, Providence, fate, supply your own term, at the last possible instant. It is not possible for a man to stand alone for long against 1,000 enemies and to discover at last that one is not alone. Is it too much to say that the commonality of our experience stands between myself and total destruction? Perhaps not. I must know, are the enemies after your Fournet as they are after Rackney? If so, how are you coping? If not, do you have any idea why not? I repeat, I must know." The letter was signed with the Fournet some Fournet's doodle beneath, and then a P.S., just one sentence, but lethal. The P.S. said, "Sometimes I wonder about my wife." I read the letter through 3 times. In the process, I killed an entire bottle of black velvet. I began to consider options on how to answer his letter. It was a cry for help from a drowning man, that was pretty obvious. The story had held him together for a while, but now the story was done. Now he was depending on me to hold him together, which was perfectly reasonable since I'd brought the whole thing on myself. I walked up and down the house through all the empty rooms, and I started to unplug things. I was very drunk, remember, and heavy drinking opens unexpected avenues of suggestibility, which is why editors and lawyers are willing to spring for 3 drinks before talking contract at lunch. The agent brayed laughter, but the mood remained tight and tense and uncomfortable. And please keep in mind that Reg Thorpe was one hell of a writer. He was absolutely convinced of the things he was saying. FBI, CIA, IRS, they, the enemies. Some writers possess a very rare gift for cooling their prose the more passionately they feel their subject. Steinbeck had it, so did Hemingway, and Reg Thorpe had that same talent. When you entered his world, everything began to seem very logical. You began to think it very likely once you accepted the basic Fournet premise that the paperboy did have a Silence 38 in his bag of papers, that the college kids next door with the van might indeed be KGB agents with death capsules and wax molars on a do-or-die mission to kill or capture Rackney. Of course, I didn't accept the basic premise, but it seemed so hard to think, and I unplugged things. First the color TV, because everybody knows that they really do give off radiation. At Logan's, we had published an article by a perfectly reputable scientist suggesting that the radiation given off by the household color television was interrupting human brain waves just enough to alter them minutely but permanently. This scientist suggested that it might be the reason for declining college board scores, literacy tests, and grammar school development of arithmetical skills. After all, who sits closer to the TV than a little kid? So, I unplugged the TV, and it really did seem to clarify my thoughts. In fact, it made it so much better that I unplugged the radio, the toaster, the washing machine, the dryer. Then I remembered the microwave oven, and I unplugged that. I felt a real sense of relief when that fucking thing's teeth were pulled. It was one of the early ones, about the size of a house, and it probably really was dangerous. Shielding on them's better these days. It occurred to me just how many things we have in any ordinary middle-class house that plug into the wall. An image occurred to me of this nasty electrical octopus, its tentacles consisting of electrical cables all snaking into the walls, all connected with wires outside, and all the wires leading to power stations run by the government. There was a curious doubling in my mind as I did those things, the editor went on, after pausing for a sip of his Fresca. Essentially, I was responding to a superstitious impulse, There are plenty of people who won't walk under ladders or open an umbrella in the house. There are basketball players who cross themselves before taking foul shots, and baseball players who change their socks when they're in a slump. I think it's the rational mind playing a bad stereo accompaniment with the irrational subconscious. Forced to define irrational subconscious, I would say that it is a small padded room inside all of us, where the only furnishing is a small card table, and the only thing on the card table is a revolver loaded with flexible bullets. When you change course on the sidewalk to avoid the ladder or step out of your apartment into the rain with your furled umbrella, part of your integrated self peels off and steps into that room and picks the gun up off the table. You may be aware of two conflicting thoughts. Walking under a ladder is harmless, and not walking under a ladder is also harmless. But as soon as the ladder is behind you, or as soon as the umbrella is open, you're back together again. The writer said, "That's very interesting. Take it a step further for me, if you don't mind. When does that irrational part actually stop fooling with the gun and put it up to its temple?" The editor said, "When the person in question starts writing letters to the op-ed page of the paper, demanding that all the ladders be taken down because walking under them is dangerous." There was a laugh. Having taken it that far, I suppose we ought to finish. The irrational self has actually fired the flexible bullet into the brain when the person begins tearing around town, knocking ladders over and maybe injuring the people that were working on them. It is not certifiable behavior to walk around ladders rather than under them. It is not certifiable behavior to write letters to the paper saying that New York City went broke because of all the people callously walking under workmen's ladders. But it is certifiable to start knocking over ladders. "Because it's overt," the writer muttered. The agent said, "You know, you've got something there, Henry. I've got this thing about not lighting 3 cigarettes on a match. I don't know how I got it, but I did. Then I read somewhere that it came from the trench warfare in World War I. It seems that the German sharpshooters would wait for the Tommies to start lighting each other's cigarettes. On the first light, you got the range. On the second one, you got the windage. And on the third one, you blew the guy's head off. But knowing all that didn't make any difference. I still can't light 3 on a match. One part of me says it doesn't matter if I light 12 cigarettes on one match. But the other part, this very ominous voice, like an interior Boris Karloff, says, 'Oh, if you do.'" "But all madness isn't superstitious, is it?" the writer's wife asked timidly. "Isn't it?" the editor replied. "Jeanne d'Arc heard voices from heaven. Some people think they are possessed by demons. Others see gremlins, or devils, or fornits. The terms we use for madness suggest superstition in some form or other. Mania, abnormality, irrationality, lunacy, insanity. For the mad person, reality has skewed. The whole person begins to reintegrate in that small room where the pistol is. But the rational part of me was still very much there, bloody, bruised, indignant, and rather frightened, but still on the job, saying, 'Oh, that's all right. Tomorrow, when you sober up, you can plug everything back in, thank God. Play your games if you have to, but no more than this, no further than this.' That rational voice was right to be frightened. There's something in us that is very much attracted to madness. Everyone who looks off the edge of a tall building has felt at least a faint, morbid urge to jump. And anyone who has ever put a loaded pistol up to his head, 'Ugh, don't,' the writer's wife said, 'please.'" "All right," the editor said. "My point is just this. Even the most well-adjusted person is holding on to his or her sanity by a greased rope. I really believe that. The rationality circuits are shoddily built into the human animal." With the plugs pulled, I went into my study, wrote Reg Thorpe a letter, put it in an envelope, stamped it, took it out, and mailed it. I don't actually remember doing any of these things. I was too drunk. But I deduced that I did them because when I got up the next morning, the carbon was still by my typewriter, along with the stamps and the box of envelopes. The letter was about what you'd expect from a drunk. What it boiled down to was this. The enemies were drawn by electricity as well as by the Fornets themselves. Get rid of the electricity and you get rid of the enemies. At the bottom I had written, "The electricity is fucking up your thinking about these things, Reg. Interference with brain waves. Does your wife have a blender?"
"In effect, you started writing letters to the paper," the writer said.
"Yes. I wrote that letter on a Friday night. On Saturday morning, I got up around 11, hungover and only blurrily aware of what sort of mischief I'd been up to the night before. Great pangs of shame as I plugged everything back in. Greater pangs of shame and fear when I saw what I'd written to Reg. I looked all over the house for the original to that letter, hoping like hell I hadn't mailed it. But I had. And the way I got through that day was by making a resolution to take my lumps like a man and go on the wagon. Sure I was. The following Wednesday, there was a letter from Reg. One page, handwritten. Fornet some Fornest doodles all over it. In the center, just this.
"You were right. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Reg, you were right. Everything is fine now, Reg. Thanks a lot, Reg. Fornet is fine, Reg. Thanks, Reg."
"Oh my," the writer's wife said. "Bet his wife was mad," the agent's wife said. "But she wasn't, because it worked." "Worked?" the agent said. He got my letter in the Monday morning post. Monday afternoon, he went down to the local power company office and told them to cut his power off. Jane Thorpe, of course, was hysterical. Her range ran on electricity. She did indeed have a blender, a sewing machine, a washer-dryer combination. But you understand. On Monday evening, I'm sure she was ready to have my head on a plate. But it was Reg's behavior that made her decide I was a miracle worker instead of a lunatic. He sat her down in the living room and talked to her quite rationally. He said that he knew he'd been acting in a peculiar fashion. He knew that she'd been worried. He told her he felt much better with the power off, and that he would be glad to help her through any inconvenience that it caused. And then he suggested that they go next door and say hello.
"Not to the KGB agents with the radium in their van?" the writer asked.
"Yes, to them." Jane was totally floored. She agreed to go over with him, but she told me that she was girding herself for a really nasty scene. Accusations, threats, hysteria. She had begun to consider leaving Reg if he wouldn't get help for his problem. She told me that Wednesday morning on the phone that she had made herself a promise. The power was the next to the last straw. One more thing, and she was going to leave for New York. She was becoming afraid, you see. The thing had worsened by such degrees as to be nearly imperceptible, and she loved him, but even for her it had gotten as far as it could go. She had decided that if Reg said one strange word to the students next door, she was going to break up housekeeping. I found out much later that she had already asked some very circumspect questions about the procedure in Nebraska to effect an involuntary committal.
"The poor woman," the writer's wife murmured.
But the evening was a smashing success, the editor said. Reg was at his most charming, and according to Jane, that was very charming indeed. She hadn't seen him so much on in 3 years. The sullenness, the secretiveness, they were gone. The nervous tics, the involuntary jump and look over his shoulder whenever a door opened. He had a beer and talked about all the topics that were current back in those dim, dead days, the war, the possibilities of a volunteer army, the riots in the cities, the pot laws. The fact that he had written underworld figures came up and they were author-struck, was the way Jane put it. Three of the four had read it. And you can bet the odd one wasn't going to linger any on his way to the library. The writer laughed and nodded. He knew about that bit. "So," the editor said, "we leave Reg Thorpe and his wife for just a little while, without electrical power, but happier than they've been in a good long time. Good thing he didn't have an IBM typewriter," the agent said. "And return to ye editor. 2 weeks have gone by. Summer is ending. Ye editor has, of course, fallen off the wagon any number of times, but has managed on the whole to remain pretty respectable. The days have gone their appointed rounds. At Cape Kennedy, they are getting ready to put a man on the moon. The new issue of Logan's with John Lindsay on the cover is out on the stands and selling miserably, as usual. I had put in a purchase order for a short story called The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet by Reg Thorpe, first serial rights, proposed publication January 1970. Proposed purchase price $800, which was standard then for a Logan's lead story. I got a buzz from my superior, Jim Dohegan. Could I come up and see him? I trotted into his office at 10 in the morning, looking and feeling my very best. It didn't occur to me until later that Janie Morris and his secretary looked like a wake in progress. I sat down and asked Jim what I could do for him, or vice versa. I won't say the Reg Thorpe name hadn't entered my mind. Having the story was a tremendous coup for Logan's, and I suspected a few congratulations were in order. So you can imagine how dumbfounded I was when he slid two purchase orders across the desk at me. The Thorpe story, and a John Updike novella we had scheduled as the February fiction lead. Return stamped across both. I looked at the revoked purchase orders. I looked at Jimmy. I couldn't make any of it out. I really couldn't get my brains to work over what it meant. There was a block in there. I looked around and I saw his hot plate. Janie brought it in for him every morning when she came to work and plugged it in so he could have fresh coffee when he wanted it. That had been the drill at Logan's for 3 years or more. And that morning, all I could think of was, if that thing was unplugged, I could think. I know if that thing was unplugged, I could put this together. I said, "What is this, Jim?"
"I'm sorry as hell to have to be the one to tell you this, Henry," he said. "Logan's isn't going to be publishing any more fiction as of January 1970.
The editor paused to get a cigarette, but his pack was empty. "Does anyone have a cigarette?" The writer's wife gave him a Salem. "Thank you, Meg." He lit it, shook out the match, and dragged deep. The coal glowed mellowly in the dark.
"Well," he said, "I'm sure Jim thought I was crazy."
I said, "Do you mind?" And leaned over and pulled the plug on his hot plate. His mouth dropped open and he said,
"What the hell, Henry?"
"It's hard for me to think with things like that going," I said. "Interference. And it really seemed to be true. Because with the plug pulled, I was able to see the situation a great deal more clearly." "Does this mean I'm pinked?" I asked him.
"I don't know," he said. "That's up to Sam and the board. I just don't know, Henry."
There were a lot of things I could have said. I guess what Jimmy was expecting was a passionate plea for my job. You know that saying, he had his ass out to the wind? I maintain that you don't understand the meaning of that phrase until you're the head of a suddenly non-existent department. But I didn't plead my case or the cause of fiction at Logan's. I pleaded for Reg Thorpe's story. First, I said that we could move it up over the deadline, put it in the December issue.
Jimmy said, "Come on, Henry, the December-ish is locked up, you know that. And we're talking 10,000 words here."
9,008, I said.
"And a full-page illo," he said. "Forget it."
"Well, we'll scrap the art," I said. "Listen, Jimmy, it's a great story, maybe the best fiction we've had in the last 5 years.
Jimmy said, "I read it, Henry. I know it's a great story, but we just can't do it. Not in December. It's Christmas, for God's sake, and you want to put a story about a guy who kills his wife and kid under the Christmas trees of America? You must be..."
He stopped right there, but I saw him glance over at his hot plate. He might as well have said it out loud, you know? The writer nodded slowly, his eyes never leaving the dark shadow that was the editor's face. I started to get a headache. A very small headache at first. It was getting hard to think again. I remembered that Janie Morrison had an electric pencil sharpener on her desk. There were all those fluorescents in Jem's office, the heaters, the vending machines, and the concession down the hall. When you stop to think of it, the whole fucking building ran on electricity. It was a wonder that anyone could get anything done. That was when the idea began to creep in, I think. The idea that Logan's was going broke because no one could think straight. And the reason no one could think straight was because we were all cooped up in this high-rise building that ran on electricity. Our brain waves were completely messed up. I remember thinking that if you could have gotten a doctor in there with one of those EEG machines, you'd get some awfully weird graphs, full of those big, spiky alpha waves that characterize malignant tumors in the forebrain. Just thinking about those things made my headache worse, but I gave it one more try. I asked him if he would at least ask Sam Vadar, the editor-in-chief, to let the story stand in the January issue, as Logan's fiction valedictory, if necessary, the final Logan short story. Jimmy was fiddling with a pencil and nodding. He said, "I'll bring it up, but you know it's not going to fly. We've got a story by a one-shot novelist, and we've got a story by John Updike that's just as good, maybe better. And the Updike story is not better," I said. "Well, Jesus, Henry, you don't have to shout." "I am not shouting," I shouted. He looked at me for a long time. My headache was quite bad by then. I could hear the fluorescents buzzing away. They sounded like a bunch of flies caught in a bottle. It was a really hateful sound. And I thought I could hear Janie running her electric pencil sharpener. "They're doing it on purpose," I thought. "They want to mess me up. They know I can't think of the right things to say while those things are running, so... Jim was saying something about bringing it up at the next editorial meeting, suggesting that instead of an arbitrary cutoff date, they publish all the stories which I had verbally contracted for. Although, I got up, went across the room, and shut off the lights. "What did you do that for?" Jimmy asked. "You know why I did it," I said. "You ought to get out of here, Jimmy, before there's nothing left of you." He got up and came over to me. "I think you ought to take the rest of the day off, Henry," he said. "Go home. Rest. I know you've been under a strain lately. I want you to know I'll do the best I can on this. I feel as strongly as you do. Well, almost as strongly. But you ought to just go home and put your feet up and watch some TV. "TV," I said, and laughed. It was the funniest thing I'd ever heard. "Jimmy," I said, "you tell Sam Vadar something else for me."
"What's that, Henry?"
"Tell him he needs a fornit. This whole outfit. One fornit, a dozen of them."
"A fornit," he said, nodding. "Okay, Henry, I'll be sure to tell him that."
My headache was very bad. I could hardly even see. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I was already wondering how I was going to tell Reg and wondering how Reg was going to take it. "I'll put in the purchase order myself if I can find out who to send it to," I said. "Reg might have some ideas. A dozen fornits. Get them to dust this place with fornits from end to end. Shut off the fucking power. All of it." I was walking around his office and Jimmy was staring at me with his mouth open. "Shut off all the power, Jimmy. You tell them that. Tell Sam that. No one can think with all that electrical interference. Am I right?"
"You're right, Henry. 100%. You just go on home and get some rest, okay? Take a nap or something."
"And fornits. They don't like all that interference. Radium, electricity, it's all the same thing. Feed them bologna, cake, peanut butter. Can we get requisitions for that stuff?" My headache was this black ball of pain behind my eyes. I was seeing two of Jimmy, two of everything. All of a sudden, I needed a drink. If there was no fornits, and the rational side of my mind assured me there was not, then a drink was the only thing in the world that would get me right.
"Sure, we can get the requisitions," he said.
"You don't believe any of this, do you, Jimmy?" I asked.
"Sure I do. It's okay. You just want to go home and rest a little while."
"You don't believe it now," I said, "but maybe you will when this rag goes into bankruptcy. How in the name of God can you believe you're making rational decisions when you're sitting less than 15 yards from a bunch of Coke machines and candy machines and sandwich machines? Then I really had a terrible thought. And a microwave oven! I screamed at him. They got a microwave oven to heat the sandwiches up in! He started to say something, but I didn't pay any attention. I ran out, thinking of that microwave oven explained everything. I had to get away from it. That was what made the headache so bad. I remember seeing Janie and Kate Younger from the ad department and Mert Strong from publicity in the outer office, all of them staring at me. They must have heard me shouting. My office was on the floor just below. I took the stairs. I went into my office, turned off all the lights, and got my briefcase. I took the elevator down to the lobby, but I put my briefcase between my feet and poked my fingers in my ears. I also remember the other three or four people in the elevator looking at me rather strangely. The editor uttered a dry chuckle. They were scared, so to speak. Cooped up in a little moving box with an obvious madman, you would have been scared too. Oh, surely that's a little strong, the agent's wife said. Not at all. Madness has to start somewhere. If this story's about anything, if events in one's own life can ever be said to be about anything, then this is a story about the genesis of insanity. Madness has to start somewhere, and it has to go somewhere, like a road or a bullet from the barrel of a gun. I was still miles behind Reg Thorpe, but I was over the line. You bet. I had to go somewhere, so I went to Four Fathers, a bar on 49th. I remember picking that bar specifically because there was no juke and no color TV and not many lights. I remember ordering the first drink. After that, I don't remember anything until I woke up the next day in my bed at home. There was puke on the floor and a very large cigarette burn in the sheet over me. In my stupor, I had apparently escaped dying in one of two extremely nasty ways. Choking or burning. Not that I probably would have felt either.
Jesus, the agent said, almost respectfully.
It was a blackout, the editor said. The first real bona fide blackout of my life. But they're always a sign of the end, and you never have very many. One way or the other, you never have very many. But any alcoholic will tell you that a blackout isn't the same as passing out. It would save a lot of trouble if it was. No, when an alky blacks out, he keeps doing things. An alky in a blackout is a busy little devil, sort of like a maligned fornit. He'll call up his ex-wife and abuse her over the phone, or drive his car the wrong way on the turnpike and wipe out a carload of kids. He'll quit his job, rob a market, give away his wedding ring. Busy little devils. What I had done, apparently, was to come home and write a letter. Only this one wasn't to Reg. It was to me, and I didn't write it. At least according to the letter, I didn't.
Who did?
The writer's wife asked.
Bellis.
Who's Bellis?
His fornit, the writer said almost absently. His eyes were shadowy and far away. Yes, that's right, the editor said, not looking a bit surprised. He made the letter in the sweet night air for them again, indenting at the proper points with his finger.
Hello from Bellis. I am sorry for your problems, my friend, but would like to point out at the start that you are not the only one with problems. This is no easy job for me. I can dust your damn machine with Fornus from now unto forever, but moving the keys is supposed to be your job. That's what God made big people for. So I sympathize, but that's all of the sympathy you get. I understand your worry about Reg Thorpe. I worry not about Thorpe, but my brother, Rackney. Thorpe worries about what will happen to him if Rackney leaves, but only because he is selfish. The curse of serving writers is that they are all selfish. He worries not about what will happen to Rackney if Thorpe leaves, or goes El Bonzo Seco. Those things have apparently never crossed his oh-so-sensitive mind. But, luckily for us, all our unfortunate problems have the same short-term solution. And so I strain my arms and my tiny body to give it to you, my drunken friend. You may wonder about long-term solutions. I assure you there are none. All wounds are mortal. Take what's given. You sometimes get a little slack in the rope, but the rope always has an end. So what? Bless the slack and don't waste breath cursing the drop. A grateful heart knows that in the end we all swing. You must pay him for the story yourself, but not with a personal check. Thorpe's mental problems are severe and perhaps dangerous, but this in no way indicates stupidity. The editor stopped here and spelled S-T-U-P-I-D-D-I-T-Y. Then he went on. If you give him a personal check, he'll crack wise in about 9 seconds. Withdraw $800 and some few odd from your personal account and have your bank open a new account for you in the name Arvin Publishing, Inc. Make sure they understand you want checks that look businesslike, nothing with cute dogs or canyon vistas on them. Find a friend, someone you can trust, and list him as co-drawer. When the checks arrive, make one for $800 and have the co-drawer sign the check. Send the check to Reg Thorpe. That will cover your ass for the time being. Over and out. It was signed Bellis, not in holograph, in type. Phew, the writer said again. When I got up, the first thing I noticed was the typewriter. It looked like somebody had made it up as a ghost typewriter in a cheap movie. The day before, it was an old black office Underwood. When I got up, with a head that felt about the size of North Dakota, it was a sort of gray. The last few sentences of the letter were clumped up and faded. I took one look and figured my faithful old Underwood was probably finished. I took a taste and went out into the kitchen. There was an open bag of confectioner's sugar on the counter with a scoop in it. There was confectioner's sugar everywhere between the kitchen and the little den where I did my work in those days. Feeding your fornit, the writer said. Bellis had a sweet tooth. You thought so, anyway. Yes, but even as sick and hungover as I was, I knew perfectly well who the fornit was. He ticked off the points on his fingers. First, Bellis was my mother's maiden name. Second, that phrase, Albanzo Sico, it was a private phrase my brother and I used to use to mean crazy, back when we were kids. Third, and in a way most damning, was that spelling of the word stupidity. It's one of those words I habitually misspell. I had an almost screamingly literate writer once who used to spell refrigerator with a D. Refrigerator. No matter how many times the copy editors blooped it. And for this guy who had a doctoral degree from Princeton, ugly was always going to be U-G-H-L-Y. The writer's wife uttered a sudden laugh. It was both embarrassed and cheerful.
I do that.
All I'm saying is that a man's misspellings, or a woman's, are his literary fingerprints. Ask any copy editor who has done the same writer a few times. No, Bellis was me, and I was Bellis. Yet the advice was damn good advice. In fact, I thought it was great advice. But here's something else. The subconscious leaves its fingerprints, but there's a stranger down there, too. A hell of a weird guy who knows a hell of a lot. I'd never seen that phrase, co-drawer, in my life, to the best of my knowledge, but there it was, and it was a good one. And I found out some time later that banks actually use it. I picked up the phone to call a friend of mine, and this bolt of pain, incredible, went through my head. I thought of Reg Thorpe and his radium and put the phone down in a hurry. I went to see the friend in person after I had taken a shower and gotten a shave and had checked myself about 9 times in the mirror to make sure my appearance approximated how a rational human being is supposed to look. Even so, he asked me a lot of questions and looked me over pretty closely. So I guess there must have been a few signs that a shower, a shave, and a good dose of Listerine couldn't hide. He wasn't in the biz, and that was a help. News has a way of traveling, you know, in the biz, so to speak. Also, if he'd been in the biz, he would have known Arvin Publishing, Inc. was responsible for Logan's and would have wondered just what sort of scam I was trying to pull. But he wasn't. He didn't.
and I was able to tell him it was a self-publishing venture I was interested in since Logan's had apparently decided to 86 the fiction department.
Did he ask you why you were calling it Arvin Publishing?
The writer asked.
Yes. What did you tell him?
I told him, the editor said, smiling a wintry smile, that Arvin was my mother's maiden name. There was a little pause, and then the editor resumed. He spoke almost uninterrupted to the end. So I began waiting for the printed checks, of which I wanted exactly one. I exercised to pass the time. You know, pick up the glass, flex the elbow, empty the glass, flex the elbow again. Until all that exercise wears you out, and you just sort of fall forward with your head on the table. Other things happened, but those were the ones that really occupied my mind, the waiting and the flexing, as I remember. I have to reiterate that because I was drunk a lot of the time, and for every single thing I remember, there were probably 50 or 60 I don't. I quit my job. That caused a sigh of relief all around, I'm sure. From them, because they didn't have to perform the existential task of firing me for craziness from a department that was no longer in existence. Me, because I didn't think I could ever face that building again. The elevator, the fluorescence, the phones, the thought of all that waiting electricity. I wrote Reg Thorpe and his wife a couple of letters each during that 3-week period. I remember doing hers, but not his. Like the letter from Bellis, I wrote those letters in blackout periods. But I hewed to my old work habits when I was blotto, just as I hewed to my old misspellings. I never failed to use a carbon. And when I came to the next morning, the carbons were lying around. It was like reading letters from a stranger. Not that the letters were crazy. Not at all. The one where I finished up with the P.S. about the blender was a lot worse. These letters seemed almost reasonable. He stopped and shook his head, slowly and wearily. Poor Jane Thorpe. Not that things appeared to be all that bad at their end. It must have seemed to her that her husband's editor was doing a very skillful and humane job of humoring him out of his deepening depression. The question of whether or not it's a good idea to humor a person who has been entertaining all sorts of paranoid fantasies, fantasies which almost led in one case to an actual assault on a little girl, probably occurred to her. If so, she chose to ignore the negative aspects, because she was humoring him too. Nor have I ever blamed her for it. He wasn't just a meal ticket, some nag that was to be worked and humored, humored and worked, until he was ready for the knacker's shop. She loved the guy. In her own special way, Jane Thorpe was a great lady. And after living with Reg from the early times to the high times, and finally to the crazy times, I think she would have agreed with Bellis about blessing the slack and not wasting your breath cursing the drop. Of course, the more slack you get, the harder you snap when you finally fetch up at the end. But even that quick snap can be a blessing, I reckon. Who wants to strangle? I had return letters from both of them in that short period. Remarkably sunny letters. Although there was a strange, almost final quality to that sunlight, it seemed as if, well, never mind the cheap philosophy. If I can think of what I mean, I'll say it. Let it go for now. He was playing hearts with the kids next door every night, and by the time the leaves started to fall, they thought Reg Thorpe was just about God come down to earth. When they weren't playing cards or tossing a frisbee, they were talking literature, with Reg gently rallying them through their paces. He'd gotten a puppy from the local animal shelter and walked it every morning and night, meeting other people on the block the way you do when you walk your mutt. People who decided the Thorpes were really very peculiar people now began to change their minds. When Jane suggested that, without electrical appliances, she could really use a little house help, Reg agreed at once. She was flabbergasted by his cheery acceptance of the idea. It wasn't a question of money. After underworld figures, they were rolling in dough. It was a question, Jane figured, of they. They were everywhere. That was Reg's scripture. And what better agent for they than a cleaning woman that went everywhere in your house, looked under beds and in closets and probably in desk drawers as well, if they weren't locked and then nailed shut for good measure. But he told her to go right ahead, told her he felt like an insensitive clod not to have thought of it earlier, even though, she made a point of telling me this, He was doing most of the heavy chores, such as the hand-washing, himself. He only made one small request, that the woman not be allowed to come into his study. Best of all, most encouraging of all from Jane's standpoint, was the fact that Reg had gone back to work, this time on a new novel. She had read the first three chapters and thought they were marvelous. All of this, she said, had begun when I had accepted the Ballad of the Flexible Bullet for Logan's. The period before that had been dead low ebb, and she blessed me for it. I am sure she really meant that last, but her blessings seemed to have no great warmth, and the sunniness of her letter was marred somehow. Here we are, back to that. The sunshine in her letter was like sunshine on a day when you see those mackerel-scale clouds that mean it's going to rain like hell soon. All this good news, hearts and dog and cleaning woman and new novel, and yet she was too intelligent to really believe he was getting well again. Or so I believed, even in my own fog. Reg had been exhibiting symptoms of psychosis. Psychosis is like lung cancer in one way. Neither one of them clears up on its own, although both cancer patients and lunatics have their good days. May I borrow another cigarette, dear? The writer's wife gave him one. After all, he resumed, bringing out the Ronson, the signs of his E-Day fix were all around her. No phone, no electricity. He put Reynolds wrap over all of the switch plates. He was putting food in his typewriter as regularly as he put it into the new puppy's dish. The students next door thought he was a great guy, but the students next door didn't see Reg putting on rubber gloves to pick up the newspaper off the front stoop in the morning because of his radiation fears. They didn't hear him moaning in his sleep or have to soothe him when he woke up screaming with dreadful nightmares he couldn't remember. You, my dear, he turned toward the writer's wife. I've been wondering why she stuck with him, although you haven't said as much. It's been on your mind, am I right? She nodded. Yes, and I'm not going to offer a long motivational thesis. The convenient thing about stories that are true is that you only need to say, this is what happened, and let people worry for themselves about the why. Generally, nobody ever knows why things happen anyway, particularly the ones who say they do. But in terms of Jane Thorpe's own selective perception, things had gotten one hell of a lot better. She interviewed a middle-aged black woman about the cleaning job and brought herself to speak as frankly as she could about her husband's idiosyncrasies. The woman, Gertrude Rulin by name, laughed and said she'd done for people who were a whole lot stranger. Jane spent the first week of the Rulin woman's employ pretty much the way she'd spent the first visit with the young people next door, waiting for some crazy outburst. But Reg charmed her as completely as he charmed the kids, talking to her about church work, her husband, and her youngest son Jimmy, who, according to Gertrude, made Dennis the Menace look like the biggest bore in the first grade. She'd had 11 children in all, but there was a 9-year gap between Jimmy and his next oldest sib. He made things hard on her. Reg seemed to be getting well, at least if you looked at things a certain way he did. But he was just as crazy as ever, of course, and so was I. Madness may well be a sort of flexible bullet, but any ballistics expert worth his salt will tell you no two bullets are exactly the same. Reg's one letter to me talked a little bit about his new novel, and then passed directly to Fornitz. Fornitz in general, Rackney in particular. He speculated on whether they actually wanted to kill Fornitz, or, he thought this more likely, capture them alive and study them. He closed by saying, "Both my appetite and my outlook on life have improved immeasurably since we began our correspondence, Henry. Appreciate it all. Affectionately yours, Reg." And a P.S. below, inquiring casually if an illustrator had been assigned to do his story. That caused a guilty pang or two and a quick trip to the liquor cabinet on my part. Reg was into Fornitz. I was into wires. My answering letter mentioned Fornitz only in passing. By then I really was humoring the man, at least on that subject. An elf with my mother's maiden name and my own bad spelling habits didn't interest me a whole hell of a lot. What had come to interest me more and more was the subject of electricity and microwaves and RF waves and RF interference from small appliances and low-level radiation and Christ knows what else. I went to the library and took out books on the subject. I bought books on the subject. There was a lot of scary stuff in them. And of course, that was just the sort of stuff I was looking for. I had my phone taken out and my electricity turned off. It helped for a while, but one night when I was staggering in the door drunk with a bottle of black velvet in my hand and another one in my top coat pocket, I saw this little red eye peeping down at me from the ceiling. God, for a minute I thought I was going to have a heart attack. It looked like a bug up there at first, a great big dark bug with one glowing eye. I had a Coleman gas lantern and I lit it, saw what it was at once, only instead of relieving me it made me feel worse. As soon as I got a good look at it, it seemed I could feel large, clear bursts of pain going through my head, like radio waves. For a moment, it was as if my eyes had rotated in their sockets and I could look into my own brain and see cells in there smoking, going black, dying. It was a smoke detector, a gadget which was even newer than the microwave ovens back in 1969. I bolted out of the apartment and went downstairs. I was on the fifth floor, but by then I was always taking the stairs and hammered on the super's door. I told him I wanted that thing out of there, wanted it out of there right away, wanted it out of there tonight, wanted it out of there within the hour. He looked at me as though I had gone completely, you should pardon the expression, bonzo sico, and I can understand that now. The smoke detector was supposed to make me feel good. It was supposed to make me safe. Now, of course, they're the law, but back then, it was a great leap forward, paid for by the Building Tenants Association. He removed it. It didn't take long, but the look in his eyes was not lost upon me, and I could, in some limited way, understand his feelings. I needed a shave, I stank of whiskey, my hair was sticking up all over my head, my top coat was dirty. He would know I no longer went to work, that I had my television taken away, that my phone and electrical service had been voluntarily interrupted. He thought I was crazy. I may have been crazy, but, like Reg, I was not stupid. I turned on the charm. Editors have got to have a certain amount, you know? And I greased the skids with a $10 bill. Finally, I was able to smooth things over, but I knew from the way people were looking at me in the next couple of weeks, my last 2 weeks in the building as things turned out, that the story had traveled. The fact that no members of the Tenants Association approached me to make wounded noises about my ingratitude was particularly telling. I suppose they thought I might take after them with a steak knife. All of that was very secondary in my thoughts that evening, however. I sat in the glow of the Coleman lantern, the only light in the three rooms except for all the electricity in Manhattan that came through the windows. I sat with a bottle in one hand, a cigarette in the other, looking at the plate in the ceiling where the smoke detector with its single red eye, an eye which was so unobtrusive in the daytime that I had never even noticed it, had been. I thought of the undeniable fact that although I'd had all the electricity turned off in my place, there had been that one live item, and where there was one, there might be more. Even if there wasn't, the whole building was rotten with wires. It was filled with wires, the way a man dying of cancer is filled with evil cells and rotting organs. Closing my eyes, I could see all those wires in the darkness of their conduits, glowing with a sort of green nether light, and beyond them, the entire city. One wire, almost harmless in itself, running to a switch plate. The wire behind the switch plate a little thicker, leading down through a conduit to the basement, where it joined a still thicker wire. That one leading down under the street to a whole bundle of wires, only those wires so thick that they were really cables. When I got Jane Thorpe's letter mentioning the tinfoil, part of my mind recognized that she saw it as a sign of Reg's craziness, and that part knew I would have to respond as if my whole mind thought she was right. The other part of my mind, by far the largest part now, thought, "What a marvelous idea!" And I covered my own switch plates in identical fashion the very next day. I was the man, remember, that was supposed to be helping Reg Thorpe. In a desperate sort of way, it's actually quite funny. I determined that night to leave Manhattan. There was an old family place in the Adirondacks I could go to, and that sounded fine to me. The one thing keeping me in the city was Reg Thorpe's story. If the Ballad of the Flexible Bullet was Reg's life ring and a sea of madness, it was mine too. I wanted to place it in a good magazine. With that done, I could get the hell out. So that's where the not-so-famous Wilson Thorpe correspondent stood just before the shit hit the fan. We were like a couple of dying drug addicts comparing the relative merits of heroin and lewds. Reg had Fornits in his typewriter, I had Fornits in the walls, and both of us had Fornits in our heads. And there was they. Don't forget they. I hadn't been flogging the story around for long before deciding they included every magazine fiction editor in New York. Not that there were that many by the fall of 1969. If you'd grouped them together, you could have killed the whole bunch of them with one shotgun shell. And before long, I started to feel that was a damn good idea.
It took about 5 years before I could see it from their perspective. I'd upset the super, and he was just a guy who saw me when the heat was screwed up and when it was time for his Christmas tip. These other guys? Well, the irony was just that a lot of them really were my friends. Jared Baker was the assistant fiction editor at Esquire in those days, and Jared and I were in the same rifle company during World War II, for instance. These guys weren't just uneasy after sampling the new improved Henry Wilson. They were appalled. If I'd just sent the story around with a pleasant covering letter explaining the situation, my version of it anyway, I probably would have sold the Thorpe story almost right away. But oh no, that wasn't good enough. Not for this story. I was going to see this story got the personal treatment. So I went from door to door with it. A stinking, grizzled ex-editor with shaking hands and red eyes and a big old bruise on his left cheekbone from where he ran into the bathroom door on the way to the can in the dark 2 nights before. I might as well have been wearing a sign reading Bellevue Bound. Nor did I want to talk to these guys in their offices. In fact, I could not. The time had long since passed when I could get into an elevator and ride it up 40 floors. So I met them like pushers meet junkies. In parks, on steps, or in the case of Jared Baker, in a burger heaven on 49th Street. Jared at least would have been delighted to buy me a decent meal, but the time had passed, you understand, when any self-respecting maitre d' would have let me in a restaurant where they serve business people. The agent winced. I got perfunctory promises to read the story, followed by concerned questions about how I was, how much I was drinking. I remember, hazily, trying to tell a couple of them about how electricity and radiation leaks were fucking up everyone's thinking. And when Andy Rivers, who edited fiction for American Crossing, suggested I ought to get some help, I told him he was the one who ought to get some help. "You see those people out there on the street?" I said. We were standing in Washington Square Park. "Half of them, maybe even three quarters of them, have got brain tumors. I wouldn't sell you Thorpe's story on a bet, Andy. Hell, you couldn't understand it in this city. Your brain's in the electric chair and you don't even know it." I had a copy of the story in my hand rolled up like a newspaper. I whacked him on the nose with it, the way you'd whack a dog for piddling in the corner, then I walked off. I remember him yelling for me to come back, something about having a cup of coffee and talking it over some more, and then I passed a discount record store with loudspeakers blasting heavy metal onto the sidewalk, and banks of snowy cold fluorescent lights inside, and I lost his voice in a kind of deep buzzing sound inside my head. I remember thinking two things. I had to get out of the city soon, very soon, or I would be nursing a brain tumor of my own. And I had to get a drink right away. That night when I got back to my apartment, I found a note under the door. It said, "We want you out of here, you crazy bird." I threw it away without so much as a second thought. We veteran crazy birds have more important things to worry about than anonymous notes from fellow tenants. I was thinking over what I'd said to Andy Rivers about Reg's story. The more I thought about it, and the more drinks I had, the more sense it made. Flexible Bullet was funny, and on the surface it was easy to follow, but below that surface level it was surprisingly complex. Did I really think another editor in the city could grasp the story on all levels? Maybe once, but did I still think so now that my eyes had been opened? Did I really think there was room for appreciation and understanding in a place that was wired up like a terrorist's bomb? God, loose volts were leaking out everywhere. I read the paper while there was still enough daylight to do so, trying to forget the whole wretched business for a while, and there on page one of the Times, there was a story about how radioactive material from nuclear power plants kept disappearing. The article went on to theorize that enough of that stuff in the right hands could quite easily be used to make a very dirty nuclear weapon. I sat there at the kitchen table as the sun went down, and in my mind's eye, I could see them panning for plutonium dust like 1849 miners panning for gold. Only they didn't want to blow up the city with it. Oh no. They just wanted to sprinkle it around and fuck up everyone's minds. They were the bad Fornets, and all that radioactive dust was bad luck Fornus. The worst bad luck Fornus of all time. I decided I didn't want to sell Reg's story after all, at least not in New York. I'd get out of the city just as soon as the checks I'd ordered arrived. When I was upstate, I could start sending it around to the out-of-town literary magazines. Swanee Review would be a good place to start, I reckoned. Or maybe Iowa Review. I could explain to Reg later. Reg would understand. That seemed to solve the whole problem, so I took a drink to celebrate. And then the drink took a drink. And then the drink took the man, so to speak. I blacked out. I only had one more blackout left in me, as it happened. The next day, my Arvin Company checks came. I typed one of them up and went to see my friend, the co-drawer. There was another one of those tiresome cross-examinations, but this time I kept my temper. I wanted that signature. Finally, I got it. I went to a business supply store and had them make up an Arvin Company letter stamp while I waited. I stamped a return address on a business envelope, typed Reg's address. The confectioner's sugar was out of my machine, but the keys still had a tendency to stick. And added a brief personal note saying that no check to an author had ever given me more personal pleasure. And that was true. Still is. It was almost an hour before I could bring myself to mail it. I just couldn't get over how official it looked. You never would have known that a smelly drunk who hadn't changed his underwear in about 10 days had put that one together. He paused, crushed out his cigarette, looked at his watch. Then, oddly like a conductor announcing a train's arrival in some city of importance, he said, "We have reached the inexplicable." This is the point in my story which most interested the two psychiatrists and various mental caseworkers with whom I was associated over the next 30 months of my life. It was the only part of it they really wanted me to recant as a sign that I was getting well again. As one of them put it, "This is the only part of your story which cannot be explicated as faulty induction, once, that is, your sense of logic has been mended." Finally, I did recant, because I knew, even if they didn't, that I was getting well. And I was damned anxious to get out of that sanitarium. I thought if I didn't get out fairly soon, I'd go crazy all over again. So I recanted. Galileo did, too, when they held his feet to the fire. But I have never recanted in my own mind. I don't say that what I'm about to tell you really happened. I only say I still believe it happened. That's a small qualification, but to me, it's crucial. So, my friends, the inexplicable. I spent the next 2 days preparing to move upstate. The idea of driving the car didn't disturb me at all, by the way. I had read as a kid that the inside of a car is one of the safest places to be during an electrical storm because the rubber tires serve as near-perfect insulators. I was actually looking forward to getting in my old Chevrolet, cranking up all the windows, and driving out of the city, which I had begun to see as a sink of lightning. Nevertheless, part of my preparations included removing the bulb and the dome light, taping over the socket, and turning the headlight knob all the way to the left to kill the dash lights. When I came in on the last night I meant to spend in the apartment, the place was empty except for the kitchen table, the bed, and my typewriter in the den. The typewriter was sitting on the floor. I had no intention of taking it with me. It had too many bad associations, and besides, the keys were going to stick forever. Let the next tenant have it, I thought. It and Bellis, too. It was just sunset, and the place was a funny color. I was pretty drunk, and I had another bottle in my top coat pocket against the watches of the night. I started across the den, meaning to go into the bedroom, I suppose. There I would sit on the bed and think about